I read all the best Bitcoin content out there so that you can listen. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read with Guy Swan. Welcome back to the Crypto Economy with Guy Swan, everybody. I am your host, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are diving into another great Bitcoin Magazine article by the many times returning author, Arjen van Veerdum, today about a layer two protocol that would actually enable public Bitcoin accounts, which is a really interesting idea. But before we jump into the article, some of you actually may be hearing this podcast for the first time on the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network. I'm going to be working with those guys over there to share this show with their incredible audience, particularly the Bitcoin Magazine content that I cover. And that's what we do here. We dig into the thousands of brilliant articles, research papers, new developments, the economic foundations, the philosophical perspectives, the historical pieces, all in the Bitcoin ecosystem. I read them aloud so they're available in audio and then talk about their significance or how those concepts and events apply to Bitcoin and the future that we are hurtling towards at about 1,000 miles an hour. So thank you to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for including some Crypto Economy Quick Reads. And if you don't know the LTB Network, then you have got to check out the awesome Bitcoin podcast over there. I've been listening to the Let's Talk Bitcoin podcast since really when it came out with Andreas Antonopoulos and Adam Levine, What Bitcoin Did with Peter McCormick, the Bitcoin Magazine podcast. I just had a great chat with David the other day that should come out soon. POV Crypto, literally so much more, and it's all in one place. So don't forget to check that out. You can find them on Twitter at the LTB Network. And I just want to say thanks, and I am honored to be a part of the gang. So let's go ahead and jump in today's Bitcoin Magazine article, again, by Arjen van Veerdum. I will add links in the show notes to the, 10 articles or so of his that we've covered on the show in the past. And after the read, we'll talk all about this new proposal and what it might mean for interacting with the Bitcoin ecosystem. And it is titled, Does Bitcoin Need Accounts? One developer thinks so, and he figured out how. Bitcoin doesn't use typical accounts. Instead, with each payment, the funds are sent to a unique transaction output. In such an output, the Bitcoin address can potentially be reused, in which case the address would act a bit like a Bitcoin account. Reusing addresses this way, however, makes it trivial to link different coins and transactions to the same user, which is horrible for privacy. Bitcoin users are instead encouraged to generate a new address for each receiving payment. While a best practice for privacy, Spanish developer Jose Femenia Canuelo believes this isn't exactly user-friendly. Quote, "We are somewhat used to Bitcoin payments the way they are, but it's really an atrocity," Canuelo told Bitcoin Magazine. "It's like using the internet without domain names, relying only on IP addresses. Only worse, because crypto addresses are way longer, uglier, and constantly changing." End quote. To solve this issue, over the past year, the developer figured out how to bolt an account system on top of Bitcoin. Having extensively detailed the idea in a new white paper, Femenia is now proposing his Layer 2 protocol, Easy Paisy. While preserving Bitcoin's most valuable attributes, such as privacy and self-sovereignty, no need to rely on custodians, the Spaniard believes his proposal would improve the Bitcoin user experience significantly. It would enable non-repudiation, recurring payments, and more. Easy Paisy Bitcoin Accounts. As a key property of Femenia's proposal, Easy Paisy would not depend on any outside source. Both setting up the account as well as using it all happens on the Bitcoin blockchain itself. This is possible because an account is created with a special transaction. This transaction has one input, the sending half of the transaction, which includes a 2-of-2 multi-signature or multi-sig address. This means that two public keys are revealed, signing the transaction. The transaction also has one output, the receiving half, which is an op return output. In this case, the output doesn't actually receive any funds, it just includes a little bit of data. The two public keys used in the input belong to the account owner who has also created the transaction, and both keys serve a function. The first public key is called the identity key, and it is essentially the account holder's digital identity. Anyone who wants to communicate with him privately must use this public key to encrypt the messages. The second public key is called the value key, and it is used to receive payments. There are two different public keys instead of one because the value key is even more valuable than the identity key. The latter is used for messages, the former for money. Quote, "The identity key must be online," Feminia explains. That opens it up to vulnerabilities, in the same way that online wallets are more exposed than offline wallets. It may be wise to keep the value key in cold storage, while the identity key is more actively used to communicate. End quote. The op return text in the output, then, also serves a function. It is a small JSON document, a machine-readable data format, called the rendezvous descriptor. This document contains information about the account. Specifically, it details which types of payments the account owner is willing to accept and how. Indeed, Feminius' proposal supports various types of payments. More on this later. The two public keys and the rendezvous descriptor are all the information the account needs to contain. When this special account creation transaction is drafted, a fee is added. As such, the multi-sig address must have been minimally funded, and it is broadcasted to the Bitcoin network to be included in a block. Easy-peasy Bitcoin account IDs. Now, people need to be able to find the account. This is where Feminius slipped in one of the nifty tricks of his proposal. Once the transaction is included in a block, the account is automatically assigned an account ID based on its place in the blockchain. Specifically, the account ID consists of the exact block that the transaction is included in and the location of the transaction in that block. This is combined with a blockchain identifier and a checksum. Like so, blockchain at block.transaction/checksum. So let's look at this step by step with a random example. Say we're using Bitcoin. The blockchain identifier then is BTC. And let's say the transaction is included in block 543,847. This is a real Bitcoin block mined in October of 2018, but that's not important. We are just making something up for now. Let's also say that the transaction is the 636th transaction in that block. Again, this transaction actually exists, but we're just making up something here. There's no need to look up the actual transaction. And the checksum, lastly, is a cryptographic trick for extra security. Quote, "It is extracted by hashing three times," Feminia said. "The hash of the block that includes the account, the Merkle root of that block, and the hash of the account transaction itself. Thus, if anyone tries to send you bad account data, you can easily detect it." End quote. In our example, the checksum would be 577. So the 636th transaction included in Bitcoin block number 543,847 would result in account ID BTC at 547847.636/577. More specifically, this would be the canonical ID, as the block, transaction, and checksum are shown in numbers. To make it even more practical, this canonical ID, BTC at 543847.636/577, can also be expressed as a mnemonic ID. Leveraging the BIP39 word format used for the Bitcoin wallet seeds, the numbers in the account ID can be converted into a couple of words or combinations of words. This should be easier for humans to memorize. The numbers in the account ID of this example can be cut into three chunks. 543847 equals cancel-mind. 636 equals exhibit. 577 equals motion. As such, the mnemonic ID for this example would be btc@cancelmind.exhibit/motion. Lastly, the Easy Paisy white paper also proposes domain IDs, which would depend on the domain name system, or DNS. In short, such IDs would include an actual domain name, as well as a blockchain identifier and a checksum, and link it to an account ID through the DNS system. For example, a domain ID would look like this: btc@bitcoinmagazine.com/561. These types of IDs would rely on an external source, DNS, and would cost money and some effort to maintain. Femenius expects they'd probably only be interesting to commercial parties. Payments. So we have an account and an account ID. Now someone, let's call him the payer, wants to pay the owner of our account, who we'll call the payee. The payer has the payee's mnemonic ID because the payee gave it to him. The account ID in whatever form can simply be shared with anyone, like an email address or a phone number. To make the payment, the first step for the payer is to convert the mnemonic ID back into the canonical ID. This step is trivial. Using the BIP39 format, the payer simply converts the words in the mnemonic ID back into numbers and ends up with the canonical ID, btc@543847.636/577. With the canonical ID, the payer can then use the checksum to make sure that the block height and the transaction number match. This isn't strictly necessary, but it serves as an extra check to make sure there were no typos in the account, or maybe to prevent someone from nefariously handing over a similar-looking account. Either way, the payer now knows where to find the account. It's the 636th transaction in block 543,847. So, he looks it up. This transaction then includes the rendezvous descriptor, the JSON document in the op return output. This rendezvous descriptor specifies which types of payments the account is willing to receive and how. This can be all types supported by the protocol or any selection of them. Of the payment types that the payee accepts, the payer picks his favorite and makes the payment. Done. Payment types. So which payment types are possible? Femenius' protocol includes four payment types. Type 0. The first payment type, type 0, is the simplest type, but also the worst one for privacy. Type 0 payments are basically just payments to the value key, and therefore involve reusing the corresponding address, like many donation addresses do today. Femenius actually discourages this type, but he still wanted to include it in the protocol as an option for those who really want to use it. Type 1. The second payment type, type 1, requires interaction. For this type, the payer contacts the payee to ask for a new Bitcoin address. The Easy Paisy protocol is flexible in how this contact is made. It can be by email, through a web page, in a chat app, or by some other means. When the address is provided, let's say through email, the payee also signs the address with his identity key. This offers confirmation to the payer that the address is really the payee's and not an address belonging to a hacker that gained access to the payee's email account, for example. Type 2. The third payment type, type 2, requires no interaction. Resembling tricks previously used for stealth addresses, type 2 payments let the payer generate a new Bitcoin address for the payee, from which the payee and only the payee can spend. To do this, the payer needs to generate a single-use public key pair, using the private key of this key pair in combination with the payee's value key. The payer generates a new public key and corresponding Bitcoin address. The payer sends the funds to this new address and, importantly, adds the single-use public key to the same transaction as an op return output. Interestingly, the payee can use this single-use public key in combination with his value key to generate a new private key that corresponds with the new public key, and thus the corresponding Bitcoin address. In other words, if the payee learns of the single-use public key, he and only he can spend the funds from the new Bitcoin address. To learn of the single-use public key, the payee is either notified of the transaction by the payer, or the payee simply checks all the new Bitcoin transactions with an op return output. For each op return output, he checks if it's a public key that he can combine with his private value key to spend the funds included in that transaction. This will often not be the case, but when it is the case, he knows he's been paid. To read how this works in a little more detail, see this article on stealth addresses and reusable payment codes. Type 3. The fourth payment type, type 3, is similar to the second type. This time, however, op return outputs must be prefaced with the identifier EP. This makes them easier to spot for the payee, but they do cost a little bit extra in fees for the payer. Benefits of Bitcoin accounts. As a Layer 2 proposal, Femenius' account system would not require any changes to the Bitcoin protocol, nor would it need industry-wide consensus. Individual wallets can adopt the proposal tomorrow, and after that, users could use it immediately. Femenius, of course, believes this would greatly benefit Bitcoin's usability, opening up a whole new potential for the protocol. Quote, "Of these, non-repudiability is a big one," Femenius said. "Let's say you go to the Lamborghini dealer to buy your new ride. Once you agree on the price, the dealer shows you a QR code and tells you to send the payment to that address. So you do. But the day after, the dealer's accountant tells you they are still waiting for the payment. How do you prove you paid? Because Bitcoin addresses are pseudonymous, you can't prove you sent the money to the Lamborghini dealer." End quote. With Femenius' account system, this would no longer be a risk. The payer could always provide proof of payment to a specific account. For Type 0 payments, this is obvious, the money was sent to the account's publicly visible value key. Type 1 payments are also easy to prove, as the provided Bitcoin address was signed with the payee's identity key. But even for Type 2 and 3 payments, the payer could prove that the payee was really paid. The single-use private key can cryptographically prove that the payee has all the information needed to identify the transaction as his and to compute the private key that lets him spend the funds. Another benefit is that Femenius' account system would make recurring payments much more feasible. Think of rent, subscriptions, or other periodic transactions to the same entity. Wallet software could be programmed to accept payment requests from a specific account, up to some maximum amount per period. For example, the landlord's account would be allowed to charge up to 0.1 Bitcoin per month if that's the monthly rent. Further, it would be much easier for merchants to return funds. This could be useful, for example, when someone makes a purchase, but the merchant later finds that the ordered product is out of stock. With an account system, the money can be returned to the customer easily without needing to ask for a specific return address. Lastly, Femenius' account system would, for the first time, offer Bitcoin users a blockchain identity. Quote, "This could, for example, mean that when you log into a website, you use your EasyPaysy ID, and instead of asking for a password, the website challenges you to sign a message with your private key," Femenius suggested. "Even if the website is hacked, you are always safe because they don't store any passwords." End quote. Downsides. All that said, one of Femenius' account system's most powerful features may also be its biggest drawback. It relies fully on the Bitcoin blockchain by embedding account data in it. Block space is scarce, however, and scalability is a challenge. To minimize this problem, Femenius in his white paper suggests that accounts could also be opened in bulk. One transaction could include hundreds or even thousands of accounts for as many users. In this case, the OpReturn data would point to an outside source for all the account data, perhaps a website. The OpReturn would also include a Merkle root for all of this account data, so the payer can check the account data against the Merkle root. While this solution would depend on an outside source, like a website, at least users could make sure the data isn't tampered with. An alternative solution could be to use a different blockchain, such as Litecoins, to open accounts. In this case, an index number is added to the account referring to Litecoin, or whichever blockchain is used. While this solution would arguably be secure enough in the case of Litecoin, it does, of course, come with the obvious downside that Bitcoin users would come to rely on a different cryptocurrency, to a certain extent. For more information and details, see the Easy Paisy white paper, link provided. All right, and that will conclude our Bitcoin Magazine article, again by Aaron Van Vierdom. And I want to talk about this and all about identity in this new ecosystem. So let's go ahead and hit our sponsor, and we will come back and talk about this piece. All right, so there is a lot to unpack with this one, but I really like this. And this is just another of many examples that have come to the surface recently about identity on the blockchain, about managing a pseudonymous place in cyberspace, and being able to build some sort of reputation system or a lasting and provable identity in Bitcoin, which, as a public-private key system, as the largest deployment of public-private key cryptography ever in history, there could not be a better candidate for sorting out this exact problem. And it is a really important problem. We've got Microsoft has partnered with the Casa Hodl guys, and there is something happening there. I haven't gotten any concrete details about it other than the fact that a bunch of people are working on it. So that's exciting just to see what they come up with. Obviously, you've got a crap ton of altcoins that have attempted to tackle this problem. And it really sucks because this was really the original quote-unquote utility of Namecoin that I feel like just kind of proves that this doesn't maintain its own network and it doesn't really provide any security in and of itself. If you have to have the Namecoin token itself, the Namecoin must compete as money despite the fact that it's just trying to fuel what is a decentralized DNS system. So without the security of the money, with the Namecoin constantly falling in value, well, you don't have any security in this decentralized DNS, so you run into the problem of, well, you know, it's easier or it's more secure to actually just anchor data to Bitcoin without actually putting it on the blockchain. In the example that Aaron gave and Femineus gave in the white paper of just creating the Merkle root into a transaction of maybe thousands of other accounts that are just stored somewhere else, which you could have all kinds of really interesting architectures, which it really comes down to a whether or not it works really well how much of a hassle it is. But, you know, you could see, like even leveraging something like IPFS or a BitTorrent to keep a database of these accounts where, you know, they're done in blocks of 100 or 1,000 or something like that, and use a Merkle root to prove that this torrent is in fact the one with that account data in it, and you have nodes that specifically are designed to download and check those torrents. There's a lot of interesting architectural things that you can do with this and ways to further decentralize it, but it's one of those things where as long as there is a means to prove who you are, it might not need to be decentralized to the extent yet most people think of it. It's like the Pirate Bay. That was why BitTorrent succeeded over all of its competitors, is it did not try to decentralize everything. It decentralized the one thing that absolutely had to be decentralized, and it left the sort of legal, like, gray areas to a market, you know, to the Pirate Bay of indexing the torrents and stuff. Like, there were numerous BitTorrent competitors that tried to, you know, create The network as decentralized tried to build in Tor privacy and tried to build in a decentralized index of all the torrents, et cetera, et cetera. And none of them really worked because they were trying to do much, too much at once and basically failing to do anything incredibly well. And the extra features actually hurt it, in particularly in like usability and in ease when you have one small problem or one limitation or lagging in getting the torrents, and then you have some lagging and limitation in the indexing and finding peers, and you have like you just end up with one small limitation or one minor hindrance on top of the other where none of the jobs are done perfectly well, and it falls to the competitor that does one job exactly as that job needs to be done, and then outsources all of the other problems to alternative protocols or businesses and other services and things like that. I mean, that's how the internet worked, you know? Like, the internet does one thing, and then we use all of these other protocols on top of it for specific things as like the second layer or the second use case for it. Like, you know, we've got TCP, and then we've got IP, and then we've got HTML, and then we've got FTP for files, and we've got SMTP for email. We have all these different things to serve all of these different roles, and through those things together, we create a cohesive experience. And that's what we're seeing, and I think this is clearly a huge part of it. So not only Casa and a lot of the altcoins do we see doing this, but we have Lightning Network being like WhatsApp, like your synonymous, your public key on the Lightning Network is becoming already an identity. And because that one is specifically scalable and you essentially are given a public key as becoming part of the network, I'm inclined to think that would be the most successful, or at least if I was putting money on which one would come out as a leader in the end, it would be Lightning Network nodes, is because you are always paying to a public key on Lightning. And but it does make sense. One of the interesting things about the architecture of Femenius' account system is that you have two separate keys, and you're basically locking them together. You have your value key that you can keep offline, and then you have your identity key. And it might not be perfectly obvious, like at first glance, why that's actually a really good idea, outside of the fact, obviously, that you can take your value key into cold storage and leave your identity key online to be accessible by other people. But this basically eliminates the sort of like man-in-the-middle attack of like I'm having a conversation with somebody who's got an identity key, who's got a public key, which I am encrypting communication with. But because that is locked in a multi-sig, which that one specifically obviously doesn't have any value on it. There's no coins on it. But it is stored in a transaction attached to the value key that's going to be used for the payment. Well, then when you reference your identity, your canonical ID, your mnemonic ID, your address, you know, for someone else to send to your account system, when you reference that, the person can know that there was no man in the middle, that nobody can insert themselves and be like, here's my account information instead of Bob, who you're actually talking to, because when you check, the communication is explicitly with Bob's public key. You're having an encrypted conversation. So if somebody tries to slip in a different account ID, well, then it obviously won't have Bob's public key attached to it because Bob never signed it, which he had to do, which was part of the transaction in creating the account to begin with. And because of that, it allows the ability to, your identity is always attached to the key that you're receiving payments with, but you're never actually, you don't have to constantly have your key to receive payments with involved. You're just attaching two together so that one is less critical than the other. And that's a really interesting part of the design. And I was having a hard time wrapping my head around the type 2 payments, which are like stealth addresses, and the fact that the person who is paying, like let's say I am paying you, what I would do is I would create a public private key pair and sign with my private key for a payment to your public key, and create an address from that. And you would basically do the reverse. You would use my public key and your private key to then regenerate the address. So on the blockchain, like on the actual transaction, this is why stealth addresses kind of hide who you're sending payments to, is because the address is actually generated by the person who receives the payment rather than being posted on the blockchain. It's being sent specifically to a hash. And because of that, nobody actually knows the address. It's not publicly on the blockchain until someone spends from it. So as long as you're receiving payment, it's safe. But then obviously you have to generate the output later, which you do with your private key. So the payer, me in this instance, is using my private key and your public key to lock up the funds, which is actually... an address has to be derived from it, and you use the opposite. You use your private key and my public key in order to derive the address, because essentially the math checks out the same way. And that's a really, really interesting way to do it and make it so that only you can unlock the coins. But it's absolute proof that I am the one who sent the payment, and that the payment was definitely sent to you without actually revealing it all on the blockchain until you want to redeem it, which is, it's a really fascinating tool. The fact that this leverages it and that you have multiple ways to actually pay people is also really neat. We do have the scalability issue. Now, OpReturn data is kind of interesting because you do have to download it initially to verify the data. But you can easily prune all the OpReturn data. So if you're not concerned with the identity system, or you don't want to, you don't have your own blockchain ID on Bitcoin or whatever, you don't have to store the OpReturn data forever. As long as you verify it, you can delete it later, and you're totally fine to do that. The problem here, though, is that it kind of encourages people to bloat the blockchain, and it does require a bandwidth concern at the beginning, because this data does go towards the block size, the block weight now with SegWit, and that has a couple of problems. For the one good thing that isn't the biggest concern is that you don't have to constantly re-up this identity. Once you create it, it's essentially perpetual until, of course, you want to create a new set of keys, or you're deprecating the old ones or something like that. So it's not like it's a ton of data in the long run. It's not as if you're, every time you move some stupid token or something on top of Bitcoin, that you have to put in information in the OpReturn and everybody has to download it and verify it. And every single time you want to do anything with it, you got to do this process over and over and over again. Well, you would only do this once, and then your ID would be just pointing to where in the blockchain you did this. And it could have been 10 years ago, it could have been 2 days ago. And it's essentially perpetual for as long as you feel those keys are safe and want to use that. So in my mind, that's not a huge scalability problem. It is a less than optimal solution, but I think there's enough value in a system like this that it shouldn't be dismissed outright just because it's putting data on the blockchain. The problem in my mind, however, is that its failure could be a result of its success. Is that if this turns out to be a really good model and really useful, is that it encourages other people. This is permissionless, right? So if it turns out to work, well, then maybe somebody else does another one. Maybe somebody else figures out how to use it for a completely different reason, and it basically encourages the use of OpReturn data in this way, like using this sort of model, and then it gets crowded out by everyone else trying to do something different with the limited data at our disposal, which would essentially, in the end, make the system infeasible because everybody's trying to bloat the blockchain all at once. So that's really tough. I really like this idea, and I certainly want to see it implemented, and I'll try to, I'll create an easy-paisy ID to play around with it and see how it does. I'm very curious about what kind of a result this would have, because it doesn't, you know, you don't have to do it for each address. Like, it is a static ID that can create as many addresses as you want from a public key. This does offer an interesting new dynamic in privacy. And if the data can be mostly stored, I feel like this is going to be one of those things that doesn't need the unbelievable degree of decentralization and trustlessness that one typically needs. Maybe if you want to pay a slightly higher fee and get one that is explicitly on the blockchain, can't be contested sort of thing. But I like the idea of leveraging off-chain data to do this, of leveraging IPFS or, you know, the Internet Archive or something like that. Just any other data set that you can then prove that yours is part of. And as long as you're storing your own ID later on, it doesn't even really matter what happens. That data can always be restored and you can always prove that you are a part of that data. It doesn't really make a lot of sense, in my opinion, to store the actual data on the blockchain, because that's what's powerful about this system, is that you can store a hash of enormous amounts of data and share the unbelievable security that Bitcoin provides amongst gigabytes instead of just the 128 bytes or bits or whatever that you're putting on the chain. The paying for the security of Bitcoin for just 128 bits is a very, very different endeavor, or a very different a security profile than aggregating it with a gig of other people's accounts and information. And when we have these other systems and these infrastructures being built with something like the Lightning Network, it's a great place to do exactly that sort of aggregation. And that's one of the things that excites me most about the Lightning Network, is that it's creating a set of payments and financial servers that are always online to communicate, to offer microservices, exactly like aggregation, exactly like a transaction aggregation, data aggregation, hashing, WhatsApp, which, you know, is already utilizing the Lightning Network public key. I wonder if there could be some sort of a amalgamation of these two systems, where you're using your Lightning Network public key as the payment key again, just like you normally are, and then you actually put in a separate operaturn key, the identity key, in that same multisig that you create the channel with, and you basically combine these two into one. You kind of smack them together, and then use like LNURL or one of these other tools that are being used to like log into a service, just like a feminist said in the article, or gave the example in the white paper, that you can just sign a message with your identity key. And that's one of those things that's really exciting, because we're getting to the point where I feel like in 5 years, I am going to be able to utilize, I'm not going to have to give usernames and passwords to most of the services I'm going to use, because I'm going to try to stay entirely within the Bitcoin ecosystem as much as I possibly can. And I know that something is going to catch steam, because there are too many options on the table right now, and there are too many people trying to solve this problem. And it's just really, really exciting to see where this goes. And I think this is something that we can actually leverage a lot of the development happening on altcoins and stuff to pull into the Bitcoin ecosystem. Like, this very interesting stuff happening with MetaMask that are enabling this same sort of thing. But something is going to solve this problem, and we're going to have persistent pseudonymous identities within this ecosystem that can be reused with proof of actually relating back to your other identities, but no actual connection to them later. And that's one of those things where, like, you can sign in by mixing your public key with a URL or with a unique URL that, like, a website gives you. And they don't actually know your public key, but they can know that your identity is persistent every single time you log in. So, for instance, I would log into Apple and then I would log into Google and I would combine my public key with the Apple URL that I'm logging in with. And therefore, I immediately know whenever I'm getting sold a shit URL because my sign-in is different. Like it's specific to the URL that I'm going to. And then same with Google, I'm combining it with their URL. But because I'm combining it with information that they are giving me during the login process, they don't actually know. Like Google wouldn't know that this that I have an account on Apple, even if they were seeing the data. They wouldn't be able to tell that I was specifically this other Apple account. But if I wanted to, I could prove to Google that, yes, this is my Apple ID. This is me consistent across all of these services. Although this actually doesn't really have anything to do with Femineus's setup here, because the ID is publicly available on the blockchain. So this is a little bit different, but it's one of those things that starts walking us towards that sort of a solution. What I'm talking about is actually more of an example of Steve Gibson, who does the Security Now podcast. A really good show if you love the technical stuff and all the security things. He tends to be very dry because he talks about really, really technical stuff. But it's highly recommended if you want to dig into that kind of stuff and, you know about computer security. And he has created this thing called Squirrel, S-Q-R-L, Secure QR Login. And it's a really neat system that does essentially that, where you keep your keys on your phone. And when you log into a website, the website doesn't give you a username and password area. It just gives you a QR code. You take out your phone, you scan it, and then mix the information that it gives you with your public key and send it back to the URL, which is embedded in the QR. So it can't be man in the middle. It can't be tricked. And nobody can, you know, steal your identity in this situation as long as you keep your phone secure. And nobody ever sees your keys. You don't ever have to put your keys on the computer. You can sign someone else in over a video chat to your account, and they'll still never know how to get into your account, and they can't do it again ever as soon as you log them out or as soon as they log out. And you can log into a computer that's totally just packed full of malware. And again, nobody has any idea. The computer has not stolen any passwords. They can't key log what you're doing. It's just a brilliant way to start separating the security of these things from the devices that we're actually using, because we have this amazing tool, the smartphone, in our pocket that can do all of this signing and communication to partner with these networks and this, you know, huge public-private key infrastructure that we have at our disposal. And it's just so cool to see the development happen on these, to see this, to see a completely decentralized option. Whether or not it ends up being the one that takes the throne at the end, I'm going to test it out. Which reminds me actually that I haven't done the PayNim address thing yet, which makes me embarrassed to think that I'm talking about this article here, and I haven't done one of the other specific alternatives to these sorts of things. Because this is something that's really exciting, and I'm glad. Thank you to Aaron Van Vierdom always for writing these things up and making this stuff available and pointing me in the direction. So I'll go read the white paper and explore this stuff, and we will see. I'm very interested. I'm going to keep a close eye on this. I will link to. I'll see if the developer maybe has a Twitter account or something, and I'll link to that in the show notes as well. And don't forget, obviously, in the show notes we will have the many, many other articles we have covered by Aaron Van Vierdom on the show. So much great stuff. And he does, like I've said, I always sing his praises about how well he will break down some of these technical developments. And his Lightning series, I have been told so many times that people have loved his Lightning series that I did on the show. It's way, way back there. It's episodes 47, 48, and 49 with a follow-up on episode 50. And I try to break down the Lightning contract piece by piece using Aaron's incredible explanation in Understanding the Lightning Network series, also on Bitcoin Magazine. So thank you guys so much. We will close this out here. I hope you guys are excited. I want to hear what y'all's thoughts are on blockchain identity, on how these things might actually roll out in the future. Which do you think is going to take the show here? Is it going to be something with Lightning public keys? Is it going to be a blockchain, like a Bitcoin account in op return data? Is it going to be something that Casa's doing? Is it going to be Paynims? What do you think? I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on it. Hit me up at The Crypto Economy on Twitter. And don't forget to subscribe to the show. That is The Crypto Economy with Guy Swan. That is me, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we will be back here tomorrow. I think I'm going to have an interview. I think I'm going to be able to drop the interview that I had with David Hollerith on the Bitcoin Magazine podcast. We had so much fun up there. So I think you guys will enjoy that. And then we will be back later on in the week with more reads coming at you basically every single day here at The Crypto Economy. And one last thank you for the LTB network. Thank you to Christian, to everybody I've spoken with over there. It's unbelievably great working with all you guys. And so happy to be able to share this content out on the LTB network, particularly all the great Bitcoin Magazine articles that we cover, because I bring them to you in audio because I know not everybody has the time to sit down and read these things, but there's just so much amazing stuff happening and so much to explore. It is a travesty that these articles don't get to everybody who's interested in reading them. So that's why I make an audio version so that you can listen while you're driving in your car, while you're doing dishes, while you're mowing your lawn, whatever it is. Guy will read to you all about Bitcoin. So don't forget to subscribe. Share this out with everybody else you know in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space. I love you all. And until next time, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.